Faith Alliance. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., where everyone is holding their breath until this coming Tuesday. I hope that however you were affected by the unprecedented disaster of last week's superstorm, the waters have receded and the lights are back on. Now, I know that's still not true for everyone. But my other hope for you is that the disaster provided an opportunity for you to experience the innate kindness and generosity of fellow Americans. An impulse that was so unselfconsciously on display in many, many parts of our country.
The intersection of interfaith work and atheism, you know, I realized that I had a story that I could use to introduce that conversation.
One young man who's busy breaking stereotypes is Chris Stedman, the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard University and the Values in Action coordinator for the humanist community at Harvard. Now, Chris has been on the show numerous times, and he promised to be back when his book titled Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious, finally came out. Well, it's coming out on Election Day, November 6th, and on this week's show, Chris Stedman returns to State of Belief Radio.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but that's a doggone season that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you, it's strictly up to you.
Although the trend towards early voting in a number of states has diluted the day's impact just a bit, November 6th is still Election Day. In addition to choosing the leader of the free world for the next 4 years, significant choices will be made at the state level in many places. On this show, we haven't spared you from analysis of the campaigns as they have developed, nor from commentary with a particular focus on the encroachment of religion into the political landscape. Well, this week, I will have a summation of the argument for separation of church and ballot box and some final thoughts about the endless electioneering we've all witnessed. But first,
the Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy is this year's recipient of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, to be given by Interfaith Alliance at a gala ceremony Sunday, November 11th in New York City. Mitchell Gold will be receiving the President's Award at that ceremony.
Well, I am delighted to say that on this week's show, you'll have the opportunity to meet Mr. Gold and hear about his human rights work, and then you'll understand why he is so deserving of this recognition. For many years, Mitchell Gold and his business partner, Bob Williams, have been building a successful furniture company. And at the same time, Mr. Gold has relentlessly pursued his other vocation, working to enact reconciliation between religious communities and other groups and LGBT persons, especially young people. Mitchell Gold lives in a place where these issues have been in the headlines recently. He lives in North Carolina. I am delighted to have Mitchell Gold join us right now on State of Belief Radio. Mitchell, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton. It's good to be with you again.
How do you describe the breadth of what you do?
Perhaps as somebody that's always been interested in history and as one who majored it in college, I've really see with my own eyes how history is repeating itself, and not in a good way, and it's in a bad way. In our country, unfortunately, religious teachings, misguided, outdated, ill-informed religious teachings, have been used by people to put themselves in a superior position to others, to marginalize others, to dehumanize them, and to cause enormous harm. So my real effort is to get people to understand that they, in fact, are doing it. Because what I've come to understand in a very big way, living in rural North Carolina, is that there's a lot of good people who just don't know the harm they're causing. And unfortunately, they go to a church, very often to a Southern Baptist church or to a Roman Catholic church, and they're being taught that gay people are sinners and an abomination, and they're ruining the moral fabric of society. And consequently, they go and vote for legislation and for people who would cause bad legislation that marginalize and dehumanize the gay community. So my effort has been to get to the good people and get them to understand exactly what they're doing. And I would say the real epitome of that is that young people, young, vulnerable, innocent, precious teens, go through enormous heartache when their parents reject them, when their church rejects them, when society rejects them, or when they're bullied at school. And that pain they go through often comes about as deep depression and, unfortunately, as suicide too often. Yeah. Statistically, 2 to 3 gay kids commit suicide a day. I want people to understand that these are the stakes.
When did the light bulb come on? When did the blood begin to boil? When did you know I've got to talk about this?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that in my past, as a gay kid growing up in the 60s, when I was 11 years old, I first started to realize that I was gay. And throughout my teen years, and I didn't come out until I was really 24 years old, so for at least 13 years, I lived in enormous agony. And too often I thought about suicide. I was just deathly afraid that my parents would reject me if they found out, that my brother, that my friends. And so I know what it's like for a gay kid to live in fear. My good friend Rodney Powell, who was part of Martin Luther King's civil rights movement in the 60s, as a black gentleman, and he once told me that as a black kid growing up in Philadelphia in the 50s, if he was bullied by classmates, he could go home and talk to his parents about that. But being bullied because he might appear to be gay, that's something totally different. You can't go home and talk to your parents about that. So for me, the light bulb went off in the mid-90s, having moved down south from New York, living there in the late 70s and 80s. Having lived in New York, I was beginning to think, well, gosh, everybody accepts gay people now. And then when I moved down here, I started to see, even though everybody was nice to me, that gay people really were not accepted. I'm embarrassed to say this, but when I first moved down here, I almost thought there weren't any gay people down here, and I just didn't even imagine that there were gay kids down here. But then I started to meet more and more people, some of my employees' children, and started to see that, yes, there were gay kids down here, and they were incredibly troubled. And that's when I started to say to myself, I've got to stand up and speak for these kids.
Yeah. What has it been like to work so publicly on GLBT issues while living in a state as conservative as North Carolina?
Well, it's actually much better than people would imagine. I have not been, heckled, or I've not been threatened, and I speak about it very carefully and very respectfully. I don't believe that anti-gay people hate me. I do believe that they're misinformed and that they're misguided. So I speak to them with great patience. I've held town hall meetings in our community. I've been very outspoken, written a book, as you know, about gay teenagers, and gave out a lot of them in the community. I find that a lot of people just don't know, because there's a conflict for them. They're being taught one thing at church, then there's the reality. They're being taught by some of their clergy that their child is a sinner and an abomination, but yet they know their child. So I've had a lot of really great, healthy discussions. That said, I am living in a community that voted overwhelmingly for an amendment to constitutionally say that marriage was defined as between a man and a woman.
Right. We've got to take a quick break right here. I've got a lot of other questions that I want to pose to Mitchell Gold. Later in today's show, a young interfaith activist who happens to be an atheist, Chris Stedman's new book, Faithiest: How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. Then later, I'll have a few thoughts to share about the other thing that is happening that day. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest, thankfully, is Mitchell Gold, my good friend. He will be receiving the President's Award at the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards Ceremony next Sunday evening in New York City. You can learn more about that event if you want to at interfaithalliance.org. Mitchell, there's been a lot of research lately showing a definite trend in American society towards acceptance of sexual minorities. Are you optimistic about the direction this country is taking now in that regard?
Oh, I have to take a deep sigh. Yes, I am. Of course, I'm discouraged when I see the kind of support that a Mitt Romney gets or Paul Ryan gets, or when I hear the Archbishop from New York spew his incredibly negative and inhumane comments towards gay people. But I think as more and more people know their gay children or cousins or family and neighbors, they come to the common sense conclusion that we're okay and we're not out to harm society. You know, David Blankenhorn recently came out with an op-ed in the New York Times stating that he was changing his position dramatically from being against marriage equality to being for it. The reason he changed his mind was because he recognized that the people who were against marriage equality for gay people really did it with animus. They did it with a mean spirit and with causing harm to gay people. Mm-hmm. And once he realized that, he didn't want any part of that. And David Blankenhorn, for those who don't know, testified at the Prop 8 trial in front of the courts in California against gay marriage equality. And for him to make a change in his position is a really, really big deal. But he, like more and more people, when they understand the harm they're causing, they change.
Hmm. You have taken the initiative, I know, on several occasions to go into a one-on-one conversation with people who have been the most livid in their hate toward people who are gay. What is it that you find that blinds some conservatives to the harm they are doing in the name of religion?
Well, I think some people who stand by carefully to their religious beliefs, they've been taught something their entire life, and when they have to change that, it kind of shatters their whole system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're talking to a Southern Baptist, for example, and sometimes I've said, you know, I just want to make sure you and I both understand something. I mean, your whole religion was based on, in the 1840s, when the American Baptist Church was split and became the American Baptist and the Southern Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And the Southern Baptist Church was based on supporting slavery. I mean, what an incredibly inhumane and despicable system that was supporting. And now, you know, all these years later, you talk to me with a holier-than-thou attitude, like you know the absolute of what the Bible says and doesn't say, mm-hmm. and you know absolutely what God wants and doesn't want. By the way, I don't have 100% success rate at all.
No,
you know,
sure.
It might be 30 or 40% or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I find that we have to give people space to think, and I equate it to selling a sofa. I don't walk in and sell somebody a sofa the first time around. You got to present your idea to somebody, give them some seeds to think with, and then a couple of visits later, people start to change.
Mitchell, one of the things that I always hope this show achieves is inspiring some listeners to get involved in issues and causes that they believe in. The two primary reasons most people remain uninvolved are, one, they feel one person can't affect change, and two, they say, oh, my life is too busy. Well, you're down in North Carolina, hardly a hotbed of LGBT activism, by and large, and you, along with your business partner, run a very successful furniture business, Mitchell Gold, Bob Williams. So I think you're a great example of someone who easily could have used either or both of those excuses, but you didn't. So what can you say to good people who care but stay on the sidelines of these issues?
Well, I would say two things. One, I would say he who saves a single life, it is as though they have saved the entire world. And sometimes when I talk to a parent or or a young 13-year-old that's on the verge of committing suicide, and I help that 13-year-old or 15-year-old or 45-year-old or parents cope with it better and come out of it feeling that the burden of bigotry has been lifted from their shoulders and that they're far better people. I mean, these are the things that inspire me to go on, and I would encourage everybody. You only have to save one life to really have a whole new meaning to your own life.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, when I first came out with Crisis, I had a big event at the local private college down here, Lenore Ron University. They had me speak, and I had Soledad O'Brien come and interview me about my book, Crisis. Mm-hmm. And during the course of it, she said to me, "What do you want to get out of the book?" And I said, "You know, I want people to stop being complicit with the harm to LGBT people. I want them, if they're standing at the water cooler, to just say, stop, enough is enough. I want them, if they hear their clergy person saying something, to go to them and say, stop, enough is enough." And because of that, there was a minister in the audience of a black church, Anthony Spearman, and he came to see me afterwards and he said, "You know," he said, I'm that person you were talking about. I've been complicit. I don't dislike gay people at all, but I've never really stepped out to help." And T. Anthony has gone on to become one of the greatest advocates in the state of North Carolina. He has changed so many people's lives. He was very instrumental in getting the president of the NAACP in the state of North Carolina to come out against the anti-gay marriage amendment. This has been remarkable work, and it was largely simply because I told people to stop being complicit. And that's what I would say to everybody who hears this and pass it on, that the truth is that if you're not helping people get out of harm's way, then you're being complicit with them being in harm's way.
How would you like to see our country change in the next 5 years, and how likely is it that that change will take place?
Well, first of all, I want to make clear to everybody that I am not anti-religion, by the way, and I'm not anti-Christian at all. I am more pro-religion now than I have ever been before. And we have to give voice to people who use the religious teachings to do good for others. I feel that we have to change society completely. I had dinner with Maggie Gallagher some months ago, and in talking to her, she just looked at me and said, "So you really want society to change totally and be like totally pro-gay?" And I was like, "Yes, there's no reason to be anything but pro-gay. You cannot tell a 14-year-old kid that they are anything less than 100%. You cannot tell them that they're broken and expect that child to be happy and healthy."
My guest has been Mitchell Gold, a man of integrity, a tireless activist on behalf of human rights for all people. In just 1 week's time now, I look forward to being in the same room with Mitchell at the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards in New York City, where he will receive the President's Award.
Thank you, Will, and I look forward to seeing you, and I hope many of your listeners have bought tickets and are going to attend.
We've got to take another quick break now, but coming right up, interfaith activist Chris Stedman, his new book, Faithiest, is coming out Tuesday. And later in the show, I'll have a few thoughts on this year's election. Now, just a reminder that there will be more of this conversation and all of the interviews on this week's show available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Chris Stedman is the Assistant Humanist Chaplain at Harvard University and the Values in Action Coordinator for the Humanist Community at Harvard. Anyone reading his new book, Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious, will soon learn Chris has done a lot in a relatively short period of time. Chris, it's really great to have you back on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. It's always a pleasure.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the book. I well remember sitting in this studio having a discussion with you and hearing for the first time that you were writing the book. I want to begin by asking you to talk about the word faithiest.
I was first introduced to the word faithiest when I went to an atheist meeting and was actually called a faithiest. And I became aware that this is one of a number of terms that exist among atheists that is used to describe a certain approach to engaging with the religious, I suppose, one that's seen as perhaps overly accommodating of people of faith and of the views that they hold. After that experience, I decided that I wanted to explore what the state of, you know, engagement between religious communities and the non-religious was. And as I did, I noticed that there wasn't much happening in some cases, and in others it seemed to be not all that productive. So I was interested in learning more about how we could perhaps find better ways as atheists and, you know, also invite the religious to similarly reach out and try to build more understanding around deeply polarizing differences.
The subtitle is How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. So talk a little, if you will, about the book itself and what led you to write it.
Sure. The subtitle is sort of risks, sounding like a bit of an overstatement because, you know, you can't sort of lump all of the religious together. Mm-hmm. And I also certainly would never claim that I have found common ground with all religious people. Mm-hmm. But it is told in a narrative format. It is a memoir because I wanted to describe and take the reader through the experiences that I've had that have led me to the belief that it is not only sort of a valuable project to try to find common ground and understanding in spite of religious and non-religious differences, but that it's actually in a world in which religion is increasingly a polarizing force in the public square, it is, you know, essential that that project be undertaken. So in the book, I describe my experiences growing up in a non-religious household and then around the age of 11 becoming a born-again Christian. And I try to walk the reader through that experience and then into the experiences in my adulthood that sort of led me out of religion and then back into being interested in constructive conversations with people of faith.
Chris, why do you even want to bring these seemingly opposing groups together? And I don't mean that really as negatively as it sounds, but I think it is a good question. I mean, you and I both have had experiences in the religious community that make us wonder if there aren't some people with whom we could never relate.
Sure.
And here you are working on bridging two communities that have been really way apart.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is, and again, the reason why I wrote this book as a memoir is part of it is really deeply connected to my personal experiences, experiences of being excluded in religious spaces and in atheist spaces because of the views that I hold and because of who I am as a person. And I came to recognize that some of the experiences that I had of being sort of othered or outgrouped in religious circles and in atheist circles were not the results necessarily of the religious beliefs of the community or the philosophies of the atheist group that I was a part of, but that perhaps it was a deeper symptom of a very natural human tribalistic, you know, inclinations to sort of group people into categories and then to shun people who don't belong to the categories that you identify with or mm-hmm. sympathize with. You know, as I began to reflect on my journey over the years, I recognized some what I thought were striking parallels between the experiences I've had in religious circles and in atheist circles. And I felt that the times when I had been outgrouped, the consequences of that kind of tribalism were similar. And in that sense, you know, I felt that it was important to look at the problem fairly for what it was, instead of saying, you know, the times when I had sort of very deeply negative experiences in religious circles was simply a problem of religion, and therefore I should, you know, reject religious communities and sort of advocate for the end of religion. Instead, I've come to see those experiences as connected to deeper human problems with relating to those that we've decided are unlike us. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I'm interested in doing that kind of bridge building work.
Oh, that's well said. I'm wondering, as you were writing, thinking of your past, were you seeing faces, remembering conversations that you really were responding to?
Mm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, I took a year and a half to write it, and then an additional nearly a year to sort of edit it and sit with it, in part because I really wanted to try and take the time to sit in the experiences that I've had and then to try to translate them for people, you know, who haven't had those experiences or you know, people who mm-hmm. haven't lived my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I went through and reflected on those experiences, I was surprised by how intimate they still felt. For example, I tried to immerse myself again in the experience of being an evangelical fundamentalist Christian and being closeted as a queer person mm-hmm. and how conflicted and distraught I felt. And, you know, this was a long time ago, and I think before I started writing the book, I felt these are experiences that are so distant that it almost feels as if they happened to another person. But mm-hmm. I was astonished by how quickly all of those feelings and emotions came back as soon mm-hmm. as I made the decision to sort of intentionally try to immerse myself in those memories again. I was holding so many different communities and individuals in my mind as I wrote this, and my hope is that the book will be able to connect with a wide group of people, because I think it's connected to so many different kinds of experiences, even though ultimately it's just an account of my own experiences. I think that, you know, because I had so many different communities and people in mind as I was writing it, that there's the potential that, you know, people will be able to connect with one point of the book or another, even if their experiences diverge really greatly from mine.
Chris, when you move from memory to vision, what's ahead of us, what do you see as the greatest obstacles to the kind of reconciling cooperative work that you want to do?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the fact that our world is so connected now and that people can really easily access and connect with people and ideas that they never would have been able to in previous years, on the one hand, that is a great advantage that we have, but it's also, I think, made public discourse and even interpersonal discourse very challenging, especially around contentious issues like religious identity or atheism. It's very easy for people to stick within their own groups and to sort of talk past one another, and we all sort of have this illusion that we are in these greater conversations, but we're actually just talking with people who are reinforcing our own views, and we're shouting at people who we see as not in agreement with us and with the views that we hold. So it's going to be very challenging mm-hmm. moving forward to find civil but also honest and robust ways of discussing these issues that can be so contentious, because we now have forums for communicating about them that allow people to dehumanize one another. And that's kind of the idea of the significance of having interfaith dialogue, is it gives you an opportunity to bring together a group of people who hold very different views and gives them the opportunity to share their stories and experiences and values with one another in a way that humanizes that diversity. And unfortunately, with the internet and with the media, it's very easy for people to just kind of talk past one another and, mm-hmm. and talk to the group that they already agree with.
Are you filled with hope? Or are you filled with pessimism?
Well, most days I'm filled with hope, and I think that this probably comes through in the book, but I recognize that I am an individual who is influenced by my environment in a number of ways. And so if I'm connecting with people who are, you know, very sort of excited about the idea of building pluralism and understanding, that really inspires me. But I have decided to take on an issue that is very divisive and very difficult And that means that, you know, I have come up against a fair amount of very sort of vitriolic, very sort of dehumanizing and personal disagreements. And that definitely takes its toll on
yes.
a person.
Yes.
But I do find that at the end of the day, I feel more optimistic than anything else because I continue to see the dividends of this work. It would be one thing if I was sort of just talking about ideals and aspirations, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if people could get along in spite of their religious differences, or if religious people and atheists could just, you know, build those kinds of relationships of understanding. Wouldn't that be a nice idea? But the fact of the matter is, I see it happen every day. I work with people not only at Harvard, but all across the country and around the world who are living out those principles, who are putting that into practice. And whenever I'm traveling to go do a speaking engagement or a workshop or an interfaith dialogue or an interfaith community service project, you know, I go with the idea that, you know, I'm going into a situation where I'm going to be trying to put these ideas into practice and to, you know, see how it plays out in the real world. And if I wasn't connected to the work as closely as I am, and I was just sort of talking about the ideas, it might be easier for me to feel discouraged or to feel pessimistic. But because I see it in action so often, and because based on what I've seen, I know that it is not only true, but it's easier than we think it is, that fills me with optimism for the work and motivation to do it.
Chris Stedman is the Assistant Humanist Chaplain at Harvard University and the Values in Action Coordinator for the Humanist Community at Harvard. His new book, out on November 6th, Election Day, is titled Faithiest: How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. It's an insightful and inspiring book, and I'm really glad you wrote it. Chris, thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you, as always.
It's time for another quick break, and then when we come back, I have some thoughts on this coming Tuesday's election. I'd like to share them with you. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. After almost 2 years of roller coaster expectations and speculations too numerous to remember, this coming Tuesday is a day of national elections on which registered voters in our land will choose whose vision and values guide our nation for the next 4 years, and likely also shape majority opinions on critical issues coming before the highest court in this land for decades to come. Think back with me over the long campaigns and ponder, if you will, some of the most important lessons we've learned in this election cycle. During the Republican primaries, not one of the politicians acknowledging that God called them to run for the presidency receive their party's nomination for the presidency. Not one. Now, does this mean that God's a poor politician? Or could it be that these would-be candidates mistook personal ambition for spiritual direction? Whatever the answer to that question, the United States still does not recognize a divine right to the presidency. A second lesson from the campaigns confirmed what previously existed as a strong presumption or suspicion. The dominant motivation of the religious right always has been and is now not religion, but politics. The goal has been power, not righteousness. The conservative religious community was divided in its loyalty because more than one candidate claimed God's endorsement. Now, if you're always doing what people say God told them to do, and that's the people you support, well, it was confusing this time. Early on, however, Despite that disparity, no voice from the religious right dissented from the agreement that Mitt Romney was the most dangerous potential candidate, and that because of his religion, what most in the religious right called a cult. The governor of Texas, like the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, and the head of the Department of Religious Freedom for the Southern Baptist Convention, decried the possibility of a candidate who stood outside Christianity. However, once the Republican Party nominated Mitt Romney as their candidate, long-held theological convictions gave way to political loyalty, and those who had decried the nomination of Romney now endorsed Romney. Doing so, they exposed for all of us either the weakness and flexibility of their convictions or the priority that most shapes their convictions. It was all about political power. Religion had absolutely nothing to do with it. Why, even the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association removed from their website their designation of Mormonism as a cult and agreed to a photo op with the Latter-day Saint candidate. Gone was the cover for the religious right, as well as the integrity of its convictions. Third, both candidates have been far more cautious than candidates in recent years when talking about religion. At Interfaith Alliance, we applaud candidates not using the persuasion of religion as a political strategy. At the same time, though, we lament the lack of attention in the campaign devoted to the meaning and importance of religious freedom. That foundational constitutional issue has been largely ignored in a time when religious groups are trying to change the meaning of religious freedom and gain support for an interpretation of the First Amendment that bows in compliance to their sense of sectarian privilege. Fourth, in this campaign cycle, we have seen as never before the power of money, to increase incivility, to demote truth to a distant periphery, and to turn an election into a contest to prove who's the richest. Sadly, even the candidates themselves have played fast and loose with the truth. In some instances, statistical errors have been made in presidential statements, but in other instances, outright lies have been declared as straightforward truths. At times, changes of positions have occurred so rapidly and dramatically that voters have been left wondering about a candidate's true plans for the future. Most presidential elections seem the most important election ever. This coming Tuesday carries the weight of such a feeling. Thankfully, though, the choices are clear this time. Hardly could the two major candidates for the Oval Office be more different. We, the people, will make the decision about who wins this election. Please vote. Another old cliche is absolute truth. Every vote counts. I urge you to participate in one of the most important days in our democracy and to demonstrate your importance and the importance of your vote. And then next week, we'll talk about the results of the 2012 national elections. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices so you can listen anywhere, anytime. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. And of course, as always, we urge you to tell others about the show, engage them in conversations about our discussions, encourage them to listen and join our discussions. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he walked, he walked.